Hey guys, this is Evan. We are listening to The Table Audio. Just a quick heads up before we jump into this episode. We started off the episode with a fairly graphic philosophical example. And like most philosophical examples that have zombies or brain swaps or people dying, things are a little graphic. So if you're sensitive about that kind of thing, you might want to jump ahead just a couple minutes. Okay, and here's the episode.
Suppose you're on your way to work and you walk every day past an ornamental pond. This morning, you notice in the pond a child struggling to stay afloat, seemingly in danger of drowning. You look around, there are no other adults, it's just you and this child, and you think to yourself, I've got to jump in and save this child or she's going to drown. But the next thought occurs to you, which is, you have an important meeting this morning, first thing. And this meeting will determine whether you get this promotion you've been hoping for a long time, which will come with a substantial raise. And not only that, but you're wearing a really nice pair of shoes and a really nice new pair of slacks. And it occurs to you, if you jump in and try to save this child, you're going to ruin these shoes and you're going to ruin these slacks. And so you think to yourself, I might miss out on this promotion and all the excess money that entails, and I might ruin my shoes and my slacks, both of which were very expensive. You say to yourself, I think I'm going to just have to let this one go. And you go, you pass by, and go on your way to work and pretend that you never saw the thing. And the child drowns. Now, what would we say to a person who did that? Most of us, I take it, would think that's abominable. That's morally abhorrent behavior.
Indeed, that is incredibly disturbing. And you may well have heard that thought experiment before. The pond case. And telling it was philosopher Tom Crisp, professor of philosophy at Biola University and a scholar in residence at Biola University's Center for Christian Thought.
So this is a case that comes from a famous paper of Peter Singer's called Famine, Affluence, and Morality from the 1970s. What Singer suggests is that what we learn from a case like this is that we tend to presuppose a principle that goes something like this, that if I can save someone or prevent someone from undergoing terrible suffering or from suffering a terrible tragedy without sacrificing anything nearly so important of my own, then I should. Then morally, I should. So in this case, I can save this child from drowning without sacrificing anything nearly as important as the life of this child. I mean, sure, my shoes, my pants, my promotion, but all of that pales in comparison to the importance of this child's life. And so because I can help this child without sacrificing anything nearly as important, morally, I should.
And of course, such a principle is so widely accepted. Some of the earliest philosophers used just this exact case. Mencius, or Mengzi, a disciple of the Chinese philosopher Confucius, he said, "Even nowadays, if people suddenly see a child about to fall into a well, they will without exception experience a feeling of alarm and distress. They will feel so not as a ground on which they may gain the favor of the child's parents, nor as on a ground which they may seek the praise of their neighbors and friends, nor from a dislike for a reputation of having been unmoved by such a thing." From this case, he says, we may perceive that the feeling of commiseration is essential to man. Elsewhere, he says, all people have a mind which cannot bear to see the sufferings of others. Really, though? Is that true? Because more and more, it just seems like we're numb to the sufferings of others. Whether by overexposure or activist paralysis, week to week in our news media and our social feeds, we even come to expect bad news. Sometimes it's across the sea, sometimes it's across the street. And let's not even assume Schadenfreude, the German has a word for this, taking joy in others' misfortune. It's not the active hope for others' suffering that's a problem in the pond case. It's the indifference to suffering. That seems abhorrent. But there's a further point to be made. Here's Tom again.
What is the difference exactly between this person's behavior?
That's the person that walks away from the drowning child.
And my behavior when I'm solicited by an aid organization with the opportunity to help a starving child or on the other side of the world. And yet I will often decide not to help because I have money that I was hoping to use for various luxuries, Starbucks coffee, eating out, vacations that are purely a matter of luxury. Singer asks, what is the morally relevant difference between the cases? And he argues that there really isn't any, that what we learned from the Pond case is that it looks to be a general principle of morality that if you can help someone and prevent them from undergoing terrible suffering at very little cost to yourself, at the cost, say, of foregoing some luxury items, that morally you should. And that since we affluent Westerners are pretty much always in a situation where we can do without luxury and send money that we would have otherwise spent on luxury and frill to help those in dire poverty, that we should, and that therefore we affluent Westerners ought to be giving with a much more radical kind of generosity to those who suffer than we do, on pain of being in the same moral situation as is the person who passes the child drowning in a pond.
The writer and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel once wrote, "The opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference. The opposite of art is not ugliness, it's indifference. The opposite of faith is not heresy, it's indifference. And the opposite of life is not death, it's indifference. Because of indifference, one dies before one actually dies. To be in the window and watch people being sent to concentration camps, or being attacked in the street, or I'd add, in a mosque, or a country music concert, or a church, and do nothing, that's being dead. If that's being dead, then how in the world can we come alive?" Today at the table, the first of a two-part series on love's response to suffering. We'll talk about what Pope Francis meant when he said we are a culture of indifference. We'll talk about slacktivism with an ethicist who thinks the world is not ours to save. We'll get into a documentary that Time magazine called the most viral video of all time. And specifically, we'll get into the difference between indifferent bystanding and inventive love. Listen on for the next two episodes and you'll hear stories of two women for whom, when disaster hit, love made them inventors. I'm Evan Rosa. You're listening to The Table Audio. I first heard these two moving stories from Emmanuel Katongole.
I never tried an elevated speech, but my name is Emmanuel Katongole. I am a Catholic priest from Uganda. I teach at Notre Dame, University of Notre Dame, in the Theology Department and the Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies.
Emmanuel is a very kind and warm man. Why did you become a Catholic priest?
Well, how much time do you have?
It's a long story. I
don't know. It's a question that I keep asking myself. I don't know. From early on, I remember wanting to be a priest. Why? I don't know. I think there is something like a sense of a call, that you feel called to something, but you don't have a real clear sense of why it is. But also the sense of a journey. And something that you can get deeper and deeper into it. Like, not that I fully understand what that is. So I'm just trying to be myself, in other words.
Yeah. That's a good way to be.
yeah, I guess.
When Emmanuel and I spoke, we started on the concept of lament as a response to suffering, and specifically the apparent absence of lament. That is, our response to the world's suffering is often driven by sort of commonplace curiosity instead of a deep-seated care. There is, of course, a personal aspect to it, but in many cultures, lament is public.
And I think it is that public element, notion of lament, that I think is socially powerful. Not that you can easily disconnect the personal from the social, but it is that social power of lament. I did tell the story of Pope Francis, that the very first journey outside the Vatican, when he went to this tiny island in the Mediterranean.
There he's talking about the island of Lampedusa, an island where North African refugees often seek solace. And the most recent disaster In April 2015, a boat carrying 700 passengers capsized, leaving a mass grave in the Mediterranean.
The migrants are washed up and many of them have died. And there he celebrated a mass for forgiveness and repentance. But during his homily, his preaching, he talked about the globalization of indifference, which has taken from us the ability to weep. Yeah. That as a community, as a society, we have lost that ability to weep, to cry.
Because you have to care.
You have to care.
And here I shall make my world debut of translating Pope Francis.
Oggi nessuno nel mondo si sente responsabile di
questo. Today, no one in our world feels responsible. We have lost a sense of responsibility for our brothers and sisters. We have fallen into the hypocrisy of the priest and the Levite, whom Jesus described in the parable of the Good Samaritan. We see our brother half dead on the side of the road, and perhaps we say to ourselves, poor soul, and then go our way. It's not our responsibility. And with that, we feel reassured, assuaged. The culture of comfort, which makes us think only of ourselves, makes us insensitive to the cries of other people, makes us live in soap bubbles, which, however lonely, are insubstantial. They offer a fleeting and empty illusion which results in indifference to others. Indeed, it even leads to the globalization of indifference. In this globalized world, we have fallen into globalized indifference. We have become used to the suffering of others. It doesn't affect me. It doesn't concern me. It's none of my business. We are a society that has forgotten the experience of weeping, of suffering with. The globalization of indifference has taken from us the ability to weep.
But there is something about the globalization of indifference that, according to Francis, is connected with the social, political, and economic realities of the world in which we live within the story, is that it is about me and whatever I can get out. I don't care about the others. And so the building up of resources, of wealth, of, in a way kind of adds to that globalization of indifference, that it is all about what I can get out. And that takes from us, according to Francis, the ability to really see the suffering of the other and therefore weep.
And would you say that there's a sort of care or a passion for the other in order to move from indifference to involvement?
Yes, of course you have to have the care for the other. But when you live within society and by narratives that constantly tell us that it is all about you, that you are the center of everything, eventually your sensitivity and passion for the other gets numbed. And I think that's what Francis is talking about, that globalization of indifference, that then we live as kind of units, individual units, that kind of atoms, and therefore the connection with the other is lost. That deep, affinitive, emotional connection with the other is lost. And also it happens when there's so much violence all around, and every time we are kind of bombarded with these images of suffering and so forth, and then we kind of try to dismiss them as, oh, just kind of a news item, and then we go on to with our lives.
This is Hiroshima, the day after the atom bomb exploded over Japan's seventh largest city and etched
first land the atomic bomb and its use against the city of Japan. And even now, after hearing many times the description of this new weapon, its capabilities continue to tempt human imagination.
Here is the motion picture spectacle of all time. A million tons of water alive with deadly rays. Awe-inspiring in its significance for man who learned how to control the atom but must now learn to control himself.
What can we do to retrain our sensitivity to suffering? As you might guess, there are no easy or quick fixes to this problem. A callus like this is hard to remove overnight, just by listening to a podcast or reading a blog. Emmanuel instead suggests it's more of a long-term lifestyle issue, that we might follow the example of the incarnation, whereby God took on a human nature to be with us, to establish a connection with us.
Francis, in a number of ways, has talked about the poor, connecting with the poor, living with the poor, living simpler lives. And in one way, he's encouraging the priests, for example, to get out of your sanctuaries and go among the poor. The priest, the shepherd, needs to smell like the sheep.
Hmm.
That's the expression that he used. He's kind of living with the poor, among the poor, that there is no better way to kind of get a sensitivity about the other than actually living with the other. There's no shortcut to that.
That's very incarnational.
Very incarnational, exactly, exactly. And so living among and with the poor at the margins is part of really rehabilitating, if you like, cultivating that sensitivity to the other. Mm-hmm. But also the lifestyle. And now and again he has talked about the lifestyle. We need to live simpler lifestyles. That is one way of opening our hearts to the needs of the others. If we don't live simpler lifestyles, we shall always be caught up in the drive to get more and more, and then it doesn't matter who is trampled along the way as we're trying to get more and more. But a kind of a settled, simpler lifestyle actually opens one's heart to the plight and the needs of the other.
We have a way of incorporating violence into our speech. Whenever we're talking about ideas, politics, religion, things that matter, there's a tendency for each side to escalate the conversation to increasing levels of animosity. We have a hard enough time understanding one another when we're at peace. Occulting intellectual virtues like open-mindedness, charity, hospitality, those are important. But in the context of globalized indifference to suffering, war, atrocities against humanity, how in the world can we expect our words to make a difference? On this matter, Emmanuel suggests that we start by acknowledging a deep fear in the human heart, a fear that can overpower our ability to listen and reason with one another in contexts of violence.
Well, of course, an open-mindedness is needed, but I think mind is overrated. It seems to suggest that we are making all these choices through a kind of rational calculation. And so the question of intellectual virtue and so forth. But most of the people that are fighting or killing one another, their lives are driven also by fear. Hmm. Either fear of the unknown or fear of what is going to happen to them, that unless they do that, they are going to end up being killed. Or just by the power of ideology that has kind of convinced them that the destruction of the other is for their own good, that without that there is no future. All these are not so much as kind of rational choices that are kind of that could just very easily be overcome by clarifying people's thoughts about that.
Mm-hmm.
So dealing, for example, with the question of fear, dealing with the questions of why people feel so demoralized. I'm thinking especially the sense of lack of self-respect. At times, in a way, violence against the other reflects a certain hatred against oneself.
Mm.
The kind of forces, in a way, that lead people to hate themselves, that often expresses itself in outwardly in violence against the other.
Mm.
So it's a kind of a more complex approach than just kind of helping people to think clearly about the situation and therefore come up with these rational choices.
It seems like a situation in which you have to lead with certain habits or almost embodied practices and then allow the mind to follow.
Yeah, yeah. But also the alternatives, people seeing that there is actually an alternative. And alternatives to be believed, many times they have to be seen. It's not just a question of abstract talk, but presenting people with very, very concrete alternatives, which they can immediately see, I think is another way to create peace.
That word, peace, most of us have a good intuition about what that means. but it can be helpful to think about what it really entails. Is peace just a buzzword from bumper sticker legalism and media morality? We are the world kind of thing? Perhaps we need to get back to an older, richer concept. Shalom. Most people identify the word shalom with peace, but really shalom is much more complex. That ancient Hebrew word has a more robust and complex meaning. It includes not just freedom from violence, but care for others' most basic necessities. Again, here's Tom Crisp, who suggests that shalom is a state of communal well-being and wholeness.
A community where the sustenance needs of all are met, where all are safe against harms, physical harms, psychological harms, enslavement and warfare and so forth. A community in which all are treated in accordance with justice, in which neighbors care for one another with neighborly care. The term that Hebrew writers use to describe such a community is shalom.
In fighting the culture of indifference, where posting a link and your pity about the latest global atrocity to Facebook counts as doing social justice, we need to think and act with more creativity, with more innovation, more concretely. That's when we move from indifference toward involvement, toward shalom. Coming up after the break, a story over 20 years in the making. One woman's response to a violent genocide and how she found love to be the true mother of invention. Coming up in just a moment on The Table. For more from The Table, check out our website at cct.biola.edu. You can sign up for our regular email journal, get access to hundreds of free resources like ebooks, short and long form articles on thought pieces, all sorts of videos. And everything we do features Christian perspectives on the big questions. What is love? Can we grow from suffering? How can we disagree well? And how can practices of humility, gratitude, forgiveness lead us to the good life? What does it mean to be human? For example, from a recent public talk on humility and political ambition. Philosopher Robert C. Roberts.
Electoral politics is an especially difficult context for the cultivation and display of virtuous pride and humility. Because of their association with power, the abundance of limelight, the enormous entitlements that are at stake, and the I'm better than you rivalrous ethos of the campaign trail, of which we've seen some horrific examples recently.
You can find that talk as well as a downloadable ebook exclusively for our subscribers at cct.biola.edu. At this point, we find our way back to those two women I mentioned earlier. Two women who were innovators and inventors. In stark contrast to bumper sticker ethics and Facebook-style justice, they offer two examples of the concrete embodied shalom that does away with indifference by living and acting in a community. Here's the first, the story of Marguerite Beranckitzi, Maggie. Her story starts with the history of a conflict between Hutu and Tutsi people in the sub-Saharan African regions near Rwanda and Maggie's country, Burundi. Centuries of hate between the two ethnic groups came to a head in 1994 with the widespread genocide of the Tutsi by the Hutu. In April and May of 1994, a span of just 6 weeks, approximately 800,000 Tutsi were slaughtered. And historian Gerard Brunier points out that this was a rate of around 5 times that of the Nazi Final Solution. The result was a mass exodus, leaving hundreds of thousands of Rwandans in exile, refugees.
A sea of bodies stretching almost to the horizon. These are the toughest of Rwanda's refugees. They've survived war, disease, hunger, and thirst. Thousands have died on the road to get here. The slaughter in Rwanda that started all this began 4 months ago. The world watched as Africa's most crowded nation plunged into civil war. Some simply abandoned their children, hoping the relief agencies would pick them up and feed them. They did, and now there is a generation of orphans.
More and more questions are raised about how little the West has done and how late it's come.
Just 6 months before this Rwandan genocide, in October 1993, Maggie was working in a local parish in Burundi, serving her community while living at the bishop's house. Amidst the conflict, the local Catholic Church hid all the town's Hutus. A Tutsi militia, driven by revenge against all Hutu, attacked and set fire to the church and surrounding buildings. When Maggie, also Tutsi, begged them to desist, they stripped her, bound her, and forced her to watch as they murdered dozens of innocent people.
She was working in the bishop's house when the militia attacked and killed all the people, 73 people in front of her, and she herself was stripped. And then they killed also her friend who brought her children to her. And she said what she was able to see in the eyes of the killers was hatred. But also what she was able to see, that how the hatred over the years had turned into revenge and counter-revenge. And so the children that were born are born into this story of hatred and revenge. And so her question was, but how do you raise children within a different story? And she was determined, because of her Christian faith, that she was going to raise these children in the story of love. Because she herself felt tremendous love. She felt tremendous love by God, but also by her family, mother. So she said she's going to raise these children in a new story of love.
And we're not just talking about a few children. Maggie's immediate response was to take in the 25 children orphaned by the militia's attack. But this single woman never once turned a child away, whether Tutsi or Hutu. As a result, many thousands of children, orphaned by the hate between Tutsi and Hutu, have found a mother in Maggie. And she's now well known to the entire nation as the Mother of Burundi, as she has welcomed so many into her Maison Shalom, her House of Shalom. You see, when an orphan child meets Maggie, he isn't merely added to an ever-expanding orphanage. Instead, he's given a home. Maggie has built over 3,000 homes in Burundi. In the past 22 years, literally rebuilding the community and establishing a stability based in peace and love of neighbor. Here's Maggie from a recent interview.
Love makes us inventor, because if you love, you will find the solution. In the eyes of those children, we have universal mission, vocation, and our vocation, human vocation, very noble, is love.
And so she says, love has made me an inventor. So she's doing whatever she's doing because it is love that is pushing her. But also she says she wants to invent love. She's inventing love for these kids. Kind of providing them with a new vision of life and what it means to live in dignity. That is very concrete love.
And that means like retelling the story.
Yeah, retelling the story, telling who you are. If the other story was telling them, no, you are Tutsi, you are Hutu, and therefore you hate the other. She's retelling the story of their own identity. No, your identity is you are a child of God. You are created in the image of God, and that is the new dignity that you will have,
and that gives them a power to operate from a different
from place. Yeah, from a different narrative. Or when the word comes and say, "Oh, look at all these poor orphans," she says, "No, they are not orphans. They are princes and princesses in the house of God." So she's offering an alternative. Yeah.
So taking a cue from Maggie, we need to live into our originating purpose. That when faced with violence, disorder, hate, whatever the pain or suffering we encounter, we imitate our creator and ourselves become creative, innovative, inventing new expressions of love, new alternatives, new narratives that operate from our shared human dignity. That's within our power as those who bear the image of God.
In the context of the violence of speech, the hatred, what are Christians to do? It's precisely to do that. How to invent love, how to, in a way, stand within a different story. And the story that within which you stand is the story that we've been talking about, the story of new creation, how the new creation actually provides a different purchase, if you like, a different platform from which to see what is going on, but also different possibilities in terms of the language that can be offered. And in case of Magi, it's that language of identity, new human dignity, that is connected with love, which according to her is the true calling for every person who is created by God. Yeah, quite powerful.
Next time on The Table Audio. What happens when an American documentary dedicated to raising awareness and trying to do something about suffering on the other side of the world goes crazy viral, but we forget about the people practicing inventive love in that very local community? Like one woman,
Angelina Atiang, whose daughter was abducted.
When the rebels, we have just watched them march through the jungles, stormed the school and abducted 139 girls from that school and just taken them captive in the jungle.
All that and even a little bit more next time on The Table. Table Audio is hosted by me, Evan Rosa, and is produced by the Biola University Center for Christian Thought, which is supported by generous grants from the John Templeton Foundation, Templeton Religion Trust, and the Blankenmeyer Foundation, along with people like you, who care about seeking Christian wisdom for life's big questions. Theme music is by The Brilliance. Production assistance by Paige Bachansky, Laura Gursky, and Jeff Hubbard. To subscribe to The Table Audio, check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts, just search The Table Audio. If you're the rating and reviewing type, would you leave us a rating and review in Apple Podcasts? That would be swell. You can follow me on Twitter at Evan Subrosa, and you can follow the Center for Christian Thought at Biola CCT, or visit cct.biola.edu. Willie, come on. I mean, I love you, but that's the exact opposite of what Jesus did. He refused to turn stone to bread. Bro, you were given one line.